sheet where you write anything you want on the first half of it. Again, if you find yourself Saturday or Sunday spending time really fretting over what you're putting on that sheet, probably you're not doing the right thing. And you might actually think back to the first exam if you actually even look at your sheet. So be very careful. You know, don't waste a lot. You're not studying by copying the book onto that sheet. Okay? So be selective. Use it for things that, for whatever reason, in your particular mind, you always stumble on. I mean, I have lots of things like that. And, you know, you're certainly welcome to put formulas, but remember, any formula that I, fundamental formula I think you need, I'll put. And you can put example problems if you think they may be useful. But I would actually advise you to put a little thought on what all the material is and pick a couple of problems that you think are exhibit lots of useful characteristics for things that ought to be important for this exam. So just put a little thought to it. But you're welcome to use that. I have also requested to schedule a room for a Q&A session at 5 o'clock on Monday. So I'll let you know when I have that. And I just want to remind you that my office hours moved in by an hour on Tuesday. Any questions, comments, worries? Okay. So life goes on, and we're in the midst of magnetism now. And last time we talked about sort of the magnetic analog of Coulomb's law, where we look at how the magnetic field is produced in space around the moving charge, or if you want to think about it, the current. And what this is described by the law of Biot-Savart, and we can describe the magnetic field at point P due to this charge moving as mu 0 over 4 pi constant. This is called the permeability of free space, times 2 times B, where this is the velocity, it's a vector, cross r hat, which is the unit vector in the direction of P, over r squared. So even though you have this r up here, this thing falls off as 1 over r squared in terms of magnitude. This is an r half, right? That only gives you direction. And the direction is required to get the direction of the field right using this cross product. If I have a distribution of currents, then you basically think of the distribution being made up of a lot of these little things, where instead of a cube, you have a d cube, which maybe is an IDL or something like that, right? IDL would be current times a length. So this is changing with time. A current is basically a q times a v or a d cube times a v, if you think of it that way. So if you think of this situation is made up of an infinite number of these situations, then you can write down this situation for each of these little differential charges, which would be this charge times IDL is the same thing as QB in current space. So that this piece becomes IDL cross R over R squared. But that would really be for just one of them. So to have the full field at point P, you have to integrate over this entire distribution of currents, whatever it is. And this can be arbitrarily difficult, but it's not so bad for very particular geometries. And we talked in an example and talked about that last time, the geometries that work. Along the way, you have sort of cross products out the wazoo, and you'll run across many instances where you need to sort of get a sense of what the direction of the magnetic field is around some wire. And we use a lot of right-hand rules to do that. They're all based on this cross product. So we've played with A cross B and QB cross B and IL cross B. So there are two other rules to use that we came up last time. They basically are based off the cross product in Biot-Savart, but they are useful enough that you probably just get used to doing them. So anytime you want to know where the field is outside of a current carrying wire, this is drawn as if it's an infinite wire, but even if it's got a curve, if you imagine you get close enough to it, it looks like a straight wire. So you can get a sense of what the field is doing near that wire by using this rule, where you grab the wire with your hand, your thumb going in the direction of the current, and your fingers then circulate around the wire in a direction, and that direction is the direction of the magnetic field. So in a world where you have an infinite straight wire and nothing else, then the field actually circulates in concentric circles around that wire with full symmetry. It drops off in strength as 1 over r squared when you go out. If you're in a world where you have lots of other stuff, then as you get away from the wire, things are more complicated. But when you're really close to the wire, that field will dominate. So it's still a pretty good picture in the same sense that parallel plate capacitors are modeled well by infinite sheets of charge, even though we never make a capacitor out of infinite sheets. If you have large sheets and you have them close enough, they look infinite if you're in the middle of them. So this can work pretty well. Another geometry you'll often run into are loops of wire, and I've drawn this loop basically looking like a circle, and usually that's what we'll run into, but not always. But you can get a sense of what's going on with the magnetic field of the loop by using this sort of also right-hand rule, which is where you grab the loop sort of circling your finger in the direction of the current flow. And your thumb then of your right hand will be oriented in the direction of the magnetic field on the inside of the loop. So the thumb here in this picture, this hand is in front, the thumb is pointing up, and the B field inside this loop is actually coming up. And on the outside, if you were to look at Vo sub r carefully, you'll find that the B field is going down. So in fact, around the loop, the B field circulates like that, sort of going in and down like that. So these are meant to be useful. Almost certainly on exam 3, give you a page of little things where you want to be able to do that and be really good at it. Not meant to be hard, but... Okay, so if we take Vo sub r, we did an example that was sort of doable last time. Was reasonable. Here's actually a geometry that you might think is the simplest geometry we could use for a current, which is just an infinite straight wire, the current flowing. And you might say, okay, let's just use Vo sub r and calculate what the magnetic field is using that current. And we looked at this very briefly at the start of class, at the end of class last time. A way to do that would be to imagine a little piece of the current flow, so an IDL here, which is at some vector d from a point p. Let's say that point p is a distance r from a point on this line. And by the geometry of this, if I call this distance x, d squared here is equal to r squared plus x squared. If I think of this as a little piece of current, then the differential magnetic field that comes here is IDL cross d hat, which is this, what we call r hat in Vo sub r, sorry for the confusion here, over d squared. And I want to know what the total field is, so I have to sum it over all those IDLs, and that would be going from, you know, minus infinity over to infinity. So that's why I have this. And I sum over all those little differential fields. So that's setting it up. Then the issue is the pieces I sum move along here in x, and this is written in terms of this vector d, both magnitude and direction. And so I want to convert what I have here in the integral into something that's along x so that I can actually do the integral, because I want to sum along x. So I can do that by doing the cross product, and you find that dl cross d is the magnitude of dl times sine theta. And sine theta, given this geometry, is this is r over d. So I can rewrite this sine theta, when I substitute it in for this piece, in terms of r over d. So there's the sine theta written in. And when I substitute in for r over d and rewrite d in terms of r squared and x squared, I basically come up with this integral. So this is actually doable. I can give you that and enroll on a test. So it's not that this is, I mean, you've actually done something of comparable difficulty when we were doing Coulomb's Law. But you'll probably all agree with me it's a bit of a pain, and this was for a very simple geometry, okay? So if this were much more complicated, like a coaxial cable or something that's a little more complicated, maybe even has cylindrical symmetry, it still would be a ridiculous problem. So it turns out there's an easier way to do this, depending on the symmetry. So let me remind you that in electrostatics, we found that we had this thing called Gauss's Law that you all love very much. And Gauss's Law tells us that if we integrate E dot dA over a closed surface, which is really what I mean by the circle, but I guess I could put then you get that quantity is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. And this then was a general, we saw that it was a general law that conceptually could be useful at times, but the way in which we spent most of our time on it is we picked very particular geometries where this would allow us to calculate the electric field. And those geometries where it was useful were geometries where E dot dA was easy to calculate. So we used examples where, say, we had a spherical charge distribution, so we knew we had radial symmetry. The dA vector for a surface, which would be the surface that we choose here, the Gaussian surface, the dA vector is also a radial. So E dot dA is E times dA. So that gets rid of the dot product, which makes it easy. And then also, if it has radial symmetry and I don't put angular dependence in the problem, then the electric field is constant at a fixed radius if I have concentric circles. So if the spherical charge distribution and the Gaussian surface you choose have the same center, then it means that the electric field is constant throughout that sum on that surface when you're summing this dA, which means it's not only E dot dA is not only E times dA, but you can now pull the E out because it's constant. So now all you're doing is integrating over the surface of that sphere. So that's what made it useful, is the choice of something that had a symmetry which we could take advantage of. So it's generally true, and it can be arbitrarily difficult. So if I gave you something shaped like an egg, good luck. Okay? So its usefulness is limited. We have something that's very similar in magnetism. So I say its usefulness is limited, but the geometries we could choose were things like spherical symmetry, cylindrical symmetry, planar symmetry, and, you know, you can actually approximate the world out of planes and spheres and cylinders. So it turns out that even though it's of limited use, at some level it's extremely useful. So in magnetostatics, we have the following law. And again, what I mean when I say magnetostatics is it's a system set up where I have currents, but the currents are constant. And in magnetostatics, we have a law which is called Ampere's Law. And Ampere's Law states that the integral of the magnetic field dotted into dl, where dl is a piece of a curve, is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. So what I mean by that is if I imagine that I have a region of space and I draw a closed curve, I can imagine around this curve I will have little arc length elements, which I can think of as little dl vectors. So if I wanted to determine the full length around the curve, it doesn't have to be a circle, then I would just sum up the magnitudes of all these little dl's. But if you're going, if you're walking around the perimeter of this curve, you're walking a certain direction. So the dl we're using here not only has a magnitude of some differential element along that wall, which is in some straight line for that instant because it's differential, but it also has the direction, which is the direction you're walking. It doesn't matter which direction. Okay, so when it goes all the way around, what this law says is that if I have such a curve in space, so it could be imaginary, it doesn't have to be real. Alright, so it's like these Gaussian surfaces you got used to imagining. Now you have these curves in space you imagine. If you imagine such a curve in space, and this space happens to have a magnetic field in that region of space, or not, I mean, but imagine if there were B, then that integral, which is B dot dl, as you go around this curve, as you go all the way around the curve and sum it up, is equal to this constant mu zero that you've now seen, times the current which goes through the loop. What I mean by through the loop is think hula hoop. If I have the hula hoop on, I'm going through the hula hoop. Right? So it's a loop and it has to penetrate through it like your finger does a ring. Okay? Could happen at an angle, doesn't matter, but it has to go basically topologically through that loop. And whatever that current is, current that goes this way would have one algebraic sign. Current that goes this way would have another algebraic sign. So that if I had a loop like this, and I had a wire carrying a current I this way, and a wire carrying a current I that way, they would sum to zero. There would be a total current of zero going through that loop. Okay? So the current carries a sign that is determined by what direction it's going through the loop. And you sum up all of that current that's inside that goes through the loop, and that then gives you a relationship to the magnetic field that is given by this particular integral. Okay, now if you look at this, I could have an arbitrarily complex loop, which means this might be an arbitrarily complicated diagram or integral. I enclosed could, in principle, also be hard to calculate. So this is really similar to Gauss's law in the sense that this is general. And by that I mean it is always true. It is a fundamental aspect of electromagnetism. That said, it is not always useful. But it is very useful sometimes. And I would say under certain conditions of symmetry. So let's look at an example. And the example I want to use is this rather painful example that we just looked at, if you recall. We have a line, a current that is infinite, and we wanted to know what is the magnetic field in space around this thing. So let us imagine that we put our eyeball right over here, and we have the current coming straight at our eye. So there's the current coming straight through our eye. And let us ask, what is the magnetic field going to look like? You can play with Biot-Savart and convince yourself, in fact we already did this last class, that Biot-Savart tells us, remember right hand rule, I grab this wire with my right hand, thumb on the direction of the current, the magnetic field is going to circulate around the wire, and as we're looking at it, it's going to be a counterclockwise direction. Its magnitude magnitude, its strength will fall off as 1 over r squared as I go out. Well, I don't know that for sure. I have to calculate because I have this infinite wire. We'll have to figure that out. But the field, you would imagine, is going to drop off in strength as I go out. But it will be the same magnitude everywhere along each of these annuli by symmetry in the problem. Okay? So the field has to look something like that. And that you get by basically looking at the problem and thinking about what the SFR tells us. So let us now invent an Ampérian loop in space which is coaxial with this wire and at some arbitrary radius r. So this is my loop. I have drawn it with dashes in it just to sort of imply it's a fictitious thing that we're making up. But think of it as a continuous closed loop that is a perfect circle coaxial with that current I. Alright? And now, given that particular choice, let us look and see what happens if we look at Ampere's law. It says that the integral of B dot dl is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. First of all, around the loop. First of all, you should notice the current goes dead center through this loop. So I enclosed in this problem is simply I. It's the I we started with. So the right-hand side is basically where we're done. It's just you turn that big I into the little I that we started with. So the left-hand side, let's look at that. Let us imagine as we go around this loop, summing up d dot dl, and we're doing this around the Ampérian loop, the dls all look something like that. Notice that the magnetic field also is tangential to the circle at every point. And I choose a direction where they're going the same direction, okay? So b dot dl, remember the dot product gives you that piece of the other vector that's going along the same direction. So when they go in the same direction, b dot dl is equal to b times dl. So we now just got rid of the dot product. This becomes b times dl. B has the same magnitude everywhere along the circle because it's all at the same radius, and that's the symmetry of the problem tells you it has to have the same magnitude. Which means B dot dl, which becomes magnitude of B times dl, B is now constant and pulls right out of the integral. And now I'm left with the integral of dl around the loop, which is the circumference of the circle 2 pi r. So this becomes B times dl around the loop. B pulls out, becomes the integral of dl around the loop. Big I is just this little I, so we might as well use that information. And this then is equal to the magnitude of B times 2 pi r, and you use the little r because that's the size of the Ampérian loop you're using, the radius, it's equal to mu 0 I. So what we find is that the magnetic field magnitude at a radius little r is equal to mu 0 times I over 2 pi times little r. If you really wanted to, you could go back and try to do this whole integral problem, and that would be the answer you'll end up with. But I hope you'll agree this was easier. Okay? So, generally, I'm not going to tell you always, but I have to stop and think about always Ampere's law is true. Generally, in magnetism problems, you're usually dealing with currents of some form, and they will all have this cylindrical symmetry because they're basically carried by wires. So they'll be like a wire or a coaxial cable, which means you have cylinders that are coaxial to the wire. And they'll all be carrying currents in different directions. They could be thick and have a current density across them that varies, but they'll all share the cylindrical symmetry, which means this is how you do those problems. is you choose Amperian loops, just like you chose Gaussian surfaces in different regions of space, and use the symmetry to solve for the electric field in each of those different regions of space. Here we do the same thing, except we basically write it as if it's the cylinder is coming through our eyeball, and we choose Amperian loops in each of the individual regions of space and solve for that type of thing in each region. Yes?
Can you define positives based on the problem? So if it's coming out in one problem, it's coming out as positive, and if it's coming in another problem.
In each problem, the direction of the current will have to be specified for you. And you'll have to, whatever that is, you then stay with that convention. And you'll have problems where you have a mix. So you'll have like a current coming out at you from some inner conductor, and then there'll be an outer conducting sheath in a coaxial cable where the current's going in. So they would have opposite signs, and you have to do that. Okay, so I hope with all your Gauss's law experience that the sort of general discussion I just gave you isn't completely falling on deaf ears, but I think it will be more useful if we actually look at an example. In fact, the example I just mentioned, which is, let us imagine that you have a problem where you have what's called a coaxial cable, which means it has everything has cylindrical symmetry with the same axis of symmetry. Okay, and in this particular problem, I am going to have an inner conductor which has a radius of A. So here is sort of a view where you're a little bit off to the side and you cut the cable and you just look at it. Here, this is the view as if your eyeball were over here on the axis and it's coming straight out at you. So this current is on the inner conductor, and it's going this way, coming out at you here. This conductor has a radius of little a, and then we have a space. I tell you nothing about the space, so just assume it's a vacuum. Maybe that's not practical for building a real cable, but it doesn't matter. We're going to call it a vacuum. And then we have a cylindrical sheath that has a non-trivial thickness. So it has an inner radius of little b and an outer radius of little c. And it is a conductor. And in this particular problem, I tell you that the current is uniform within each of the conductors. This conductor, the current is going into the board. This conductor is coming out at you. And it is spread uniformly across the area of the conductor. Okay? And then, I mean, I could give you this as a problem and then say B in all states. So how would you do that? So to do this problem, you want to look at the regions of space that are available where everything is sort of the same. And the regions of space that are in this problem, they all share cylindrical symmetry. And you'll have one region of space which is in this part, where you have a radius less than little a. You have one region which is between these two, where you have a radius between little a and little b. Then you have this region of space between B and C, and then you have the space outside the cable. So there are four different regions of space. So the way to do this problem is just like a Gauss's law problem. You basically choose each particular region of space and go through it stepwise using Ampere's law. So what I'd like to do is to choose a coaxial Amperian loop, which is meant to be a circle that is centered at the symmetry axis of this piece, which is not in the drawing, sorry. And I will choose it to have a radius little r. And what I would like to do is then I want to find B for
R less than A. And I want to use Ampere's law because this exhibits the same symmetry that we used a moment ago. All of the tricks we use there will work here. So the integral of B dot dl around this Amperean loop is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. So if we look at the left-hand side, the current is coming out at you, right, around that Amperean loop. Then I can imagine that I can use my right-hand rule and imagine the current that's inside that loop as a wire that's coming toward you. So I know that it is circulating counterclockwise. And because this problem has no angular dependence, and it's all just because of the symmetry of the problem, I know that the field will be uniform at a fixed radius. I mean, not uniform, it'll be constant in magnitude at a fixed radius. Okay, and it'll be circulating counterclockwise. So that means with this choice of Amperean loop, I can imagine I have, here's my loop. Okay. Here's my loop with fixed R. I'll have B doing this, and I'll have my little DLs doing this. So B dot DL is B times DL. The magnitude is the same at that radius because of the symmetry of the problem. So B times DL becomes a constant B times DL. And so I can pull that B out of the integral. Which is B times 2 pi R. So it's exactly what we did a moment ago in terms of the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we need to know what is the current that's inside this loop. And in this particular case, that starts to be a little bit of the problem. Because now, imagine, here is my inner conductor of radius A. Here is my Amperean loop of radius little r, and what I'm told is that my current is uniformly spread over that whole region. So we have to think a little bit about something which is called a current density. So you imagine that this current is uniformly spread and coming through this conductor. It's as if it has a current aerial density that's uniform across this thing as I cut it and look at it. So, we'll define something, and we'll call it J. J is a vector because the current density will have both a magnitude and a direction. It is a function of radius in this problem. And I'll call it the current density. In this particular problem, okay, so in a given problem, this current density could be anything. I could make some incredibly complex mathematical function and call that current density. The most complex I will get for you is to give it a radial dependence. I will not give it an angular dependence, and that makes life easier. In this particular problem, I've given it no radial dependence. I've just said it's constant. But that makes this problem easier. If I want to make it harder, I put a radial dependence to that J. At any rate, so in principle, it's a function of R. So in this particular problem, J is actually constant with R in that region. And what the current density will be is the total current that you have in that region divided by the area of that region, which is pi times A squared. That would be, So what I'm doing to get the current density is I'm taking the total current coming through on this in the circle, and I'm dividing it by the area of that bigger circle. Okay? And that then is the uniform current density that is coming through upon that circle. And it's a constant because there's no R in that. So that just happens to be a specific for this problem. So I enclosed, which is what I want to calculate here, this I enclosed, is how much of the current, given that current density, how much of the current is coming through the Amperian loop? So since I called it a little I up on top, I'll call it little I here. And the way to get that is to integrate the current density in that region. So this would be the integral of J dA, where this is the over the area of the Amperian loop. So this would be the integral from 0 to little r, where r little r is the radius of the Amperian loop, of j times 2 pi r dr. So I'm imagining that I have, there's a, oh boy, this is going to be too small. Let me make it bigger. So there's the interconductor. We've chosen an Amperian loop that we say has this radius, R. And to integrate, because of the symmetry of the problem, I assume that I have a little thin piece in here, which has thickness dr, and has a circumference 2 pi, let me give it a different thing, different dr prime, has a circumference 2 pi r prime, so that when I take dA, dA becomes 2 pi r prime dr prime. So this becomes J, which is a constant, times 2 pi r squared over 2, which is J times pi r squared. All right. Now, if I haven't put you to sleep and you're paying attention, you may have thought, well, duh, because I haven't constant current density coming through here, all I have to do is multiply it by the area of this piece here, which is, it's a circle, so it's pi squared, right? So that's what I have, j times pi little r squared. And that's fine, and that works well when the current density is constant. When the current density is constant, this j pulls out, the 2 pi pulls out, it's the integral of r dr, and that gives you the r squared over 2, and you're good. If I get if I put a radial dependence on the current density, then this j becomes a function of r, and you can't pull it out of the integral, and you have to actually do the integral. Okay, so if I'm in a bad mood and want to make one of these problems harder for you, that's how I do it. I make j 1 over r squared, or, you know, the hyperbolic tangent of cosine r, or something like that. Then life becomes much harder for you. But if it's a bit easier, then it's really pretty easy because it's just area scaling. That's all you have to worry about. When you've done a few of these problems, you probably won't pull out an integral for this type of thing because it's constant, and you'll just start doing the area scaling for the circles, and you'll be good. Okay. So So what we have, let's look at this. So to get an answer then for this part, we're looking for B in this region of space, R less than A. What we found is the left-hand side is B times 2 pi R, and the right-hand side is mu 0 times J times pi R squared. So let's see if we can write that down. So the left-hand side is B times 2 pi R. And the right-hand side is J times pi R squared. And J is equal to pi over pi A squared. So we get that B, the magnitude of B at R less than A, is equal to pi over pi A squared times pi R squared divided by 2 pi R, which is equal to I R over 2 A pi. If I did that right.
Wait, it would be squared, right?
Which?
So it would be I R over 2 pi A squared.
No. 2 pi, yes.
Okay, and also what happens in mu? What's that about?
I dropped it. So I was looking at current density here. Yeah, so the mu would go here. So the mu goes here. So the mu goes here. So we get it that. Okay? And glance at it for a second. This is an area, basically. So this goes as a 1 over. It's increasing as you go out in R because of this. And that makes sense if you think about it, because you're sort of including more and more current inside that loop as you go out. Okay. All right? You're not completely done. If I really ask for B in all space, I mean, of course, this is just one of the four regions, so we'll go to the others in a second. But even for this region, we're still not done because B is a vector. So you have to look at this and go, this is the magnitude of B. And so now you have to give me some information. And there are different ways in which you could do it. You could have said early on, you could say, well, if there's a B, from the symmetry of the problem, I know that it's going to circulate this way or that way, right? Because it's a cylindrical problem. Inside here, if you're grabbing I with your hand, it's going to circulate this way because the only I is that direction. It's less obvious as you start getting out here because you have I's going in different directions. So in principle, it could counter-rotate one way or the other. So you have to be a little bit careful with this. Here, you can refer to at the end, you can say, referring to the drawing at the start, the field here is rotating counterclockwise. So, to fully answer this, you would then say the direction something like this. And then, once I've said that, I can make that a vector, and now I really have a full answer for that particular piece. Okay, any questions on that? Alright, so now, I'm going to take advantage of the same symmetry, all the same symmetry tricks for the other space, so I'll do them a little bit faster now. So what I'd like to look at now would be the region of space where R is greater than little a and less than little b, So I want to choose the region of space in between the two conductors. So I want to put an Amperian loop in this region. And now when I refer to little r, I'm talking about that one. It has all the same symmetry problems that we've just dealt with. So we start with Ampere's law. The left-hand side, B is going to be uniform in magnitude around the circle because it's all at one radius. B is going to be tangential to the circle because the current that's enclosed is their cylindrical symmetry, and it's going to be rotating counterclockwise because the current that's inside it is what drives that. And it's if I grab it, the right-hand rule tells me it goes counterclockwise. And if you ever question that or you're worried that you're using your left hand instead of your right hand, you can use Biot-Savart and convince yourself of that. Of course, that also requires that you do the right-hand rule. Okay. So maybe you want to learn which hand's which. But so B dot dl becomes B times dl. B is constant at that fixed radius. B pulls out. The integral of dl is 2 pi r. So I get B times 2 pi r on the left-hand side. The right-hand side in this case is trivial because what you have is the current I that penetrates through that loop. And there is no current in this region, so you don't have to worry about it. The full I goes through. So you just can write down this is I times mu zero, and B is equal to mu zero times I over 2 pi r. Okay, and this is, if you recall, if you look at this, this is B is mu zero times I times 2 pi r over 2 pi r. When we did the infinite wire, thinking of the wire as having no internal radius, just as a thin line, we also got mu zero I over 2 pi r. So in the same way where we use Gauss's law, and you have a spherical charge distribution, when you get outside that charge distribution, you get the same solution for the electric field as you do if all that charge were at a point. In Ampere's law, you get the same solution for the field outside of an infinite cylindrical current distribution as if all of that current were condensed in one thin infinite wire. Okay, so it's really very similar in that sense. Partly why you'd like to sort of make sure you connect with what I just said and use it at times is because it's a way of knowing that you haven't done something stupid. I mean, put that one on your sheet, come exam three. It's a useful thing to know. Once you've got it, when you get to a problem where you have something like this, where you have some current distribution and now you're outside of it, you better get that answer. If you don't, then you're doing something silly. Okay, so you can always sort of check yourself on that. Again, this is going to be B is counterclockwise by that earlier definition. Okay, so we've done two of the regions of space. Now what I'd like to do is to look at the region here. So I'm inside the outer conductor. So I choose an Amperian loop that has a radius that is inside the region of interest that I'm dealing with. This time, you can imagine life is going to be a little bit more complicated because I have this full I going through one way, but now I have a partial current going the other direction here. So there's going to be a couple of pieces that come into play for the I. But we basically do the same old thing that we've been doing. We take Well, let's specify the direction, what we're doing. We're doing R, which is greater than B and less than C. And we choose to use Ampere's law. This is another way to write it. Instead of maybe putting closed loop down here, I can put that little circle around the integral, which means basically you're going all the way around the loop. Mu zero. Times I enclosed. So the left-hand side has the same symmetry as we've already seen several times. So it becomes B times 2 pi R. The right-hand side is a little harder. So let's think of that. I enclose must equal, well, if I look at the current that's inside that Amperean loop, I have a full I that is coming out at us, which I'll take as a positive I. And then I have a fraction of this other I that's going into the loop. Okay, so that comes in with a negative sign. That's how I take into account that it's going the opposite direction. So I'm going to put a minus sign. And then here I'm going to go ahead and use area scaling. First of all, I care, what is the current density here? This problem tells you the current is uniform here, and it's uniform here, but it doesn't tell you that it has the same current density. Because those areas are different. It just tells you it's uniform. So I have to figure out what is the current density in that region. So imagine then I have this region, and the question is, what is our current density? Well, the current density is going to be J. In this case, it's not a function of R because I told you it's constant. J is equal to the total current you have I divided by the area that you have for that whole conductor because it's spread over that whole conductor. So that's going to be equal to the area of the outer circle minus the area of the inner circle. So that's going to be pi C squared minus pi B squared. The area of this outer circle, C, minus the area of the inner circle, B, gives you the area that's in here. So if I take the total current divided by that total area, this has to be the current density in that whole region. So I can take I minus the current density times the area of this piece, which happens to be included inside the Amperean loop, which is the pink circle, which is a subset of the area of that whole outer zone. The area that is enclosed inside the pink, but outside radius B, so this little thin piece right here, is equal to the radius of, is equal to the area of the pink circle minus the area of this inner circle. Okay? So I want to get the I enclosed in that piece, I want to take the constant current density and multiply it by that area. So this J gets multiplied by pi R squared minus pi B squared. So this becomes I minus I over pi C squared minus pi B squared times pi R squared minus pi B squared. So the area scaling gets a bit annoying. I can rewrite this as I times 1 minus we having fun yet? All right, so almost done. That's I enclosed. So if I multiply that nasty quantity by mu zero, then I can solve for B. So B in this region of R greater than little b and less than C is equal to mu zero over 2 pi little r times I times this 1 minus Can you imagine a way in which you might look at that ratio that we have written here in this part of the problem and figure out whether you've got that area scaling right, whether you have that ratio right? What happens if little r, okay, that's the Let us suppose that little r here approaches little b. How much area do you have?
Zero.
So whenever I look at this area scaling, if this little r approaches little b, this top goes to zero. There's no current. So that tells you that's good. If this little r approaches big C, what happens? If little r approaches big C, I have pi c squared over minus pi b squared, pi c squared minus pi b squared. This becomes 1. And what it tells you is that the total current you have inside the Amperian loop as you get out here is 0, which is true. Inside the loop, you have an I coming out of you, and you have an I going in, and they cancel out. Okay? So, as sort of complicated as this sort of seemed to get, if you sit and look at the problem and think about it, there is an easy way to check it. Sort of, it has to make sense. And if you didn't have that, and if it didn't approach zero as this goes, then it's not negotiable. You screwed something up, and you have to go back and figure out what you did wrong. And it's actually extremely easy to do that. You saw that we have a lot of radii pointing around. We're doing this area scaling. We're looking at this pi r squared minus the pi b squared, blah, blah, blah. Going through that, it's really easy to write the wrong thing down. You just mix up an A or a B as you're going through all this complicated area scaling. Even if you know exactly what you're doing, it's easy to make that mistake. So if you have a problem where you can do this type of thinking to sort of figure out whether what you've got makes any sense, you really need to do it because it can catch the error for you. Now, in this problem, we have to think a little bit harder, too, because we need to know the direction. If I want to convert this to a vector, I have to tell you what direction it's going. And in this case, the inside is coming that way, and it will give you a field that's like so. And the outside piece, this piece, is going to contribute a field that counter-rotates, and those things basically have to add together. And I think what I would do in this case is I would say that the field rotates counterclockwise because I've defined that as sort of the positive direction of rotation relative to the direction of this I. And because I have opposite signs here, if it's truly counter-rotating the other way, it's because this term is bigger than that term. All right, so that would give you the direction. So in that case, I would go ahead and let this sign define the direction of rotation and just say that this goes clockwise. Counterclockwise, sorry. Okay, so this problem We all want this problem to die by the time we get to this stage. I'm looking for a clean drawing. Alright, so here we go. And I don't want to use that imperium. So for the final piece of this problem, we want to choose R greater than C because we have to deal with the world outside here. So now R is there. And in this case, we pull out Ampere's law, integral of B dot dl is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. In this case, the B dot dl, the symmetry is the same as always in this part of the problem, 2 pi r. But the right-hand side, now I enclosed is 0 because I have an I on the inner sheath going one way, I on the outer sheath going another way. So B is equal to 0. Okay with that? All right, and at that point, we're done with this stupid problem. Okay. I tried to take my time so that this was understandable. And you may look at this and think, oh my God, how many of these problems are we going to have to do? Some of them will be thorny, I'm sure. But one of the things you'll find is what we just did, you'll get real fast out because a lot of it is pretty quick once you figure out all the pieces that go into it. Now, notice that what we have is the magnetic field outside this coaxial conductor is 0. Did you ever, as you were growing up, ponder why anyone would ever make a coaxial cable? Did that bother you? I know it bothered me when I was growing up. I was like, oh my God, coaxial cables are complicated. They're expensive to make. Why in the world would anybody do that? Why not just run a straight line? Here's one of the reasons. If you have a straight wire, you're going to have magnetic field lines all over the place. And that can be a bad thing. We will soon find out why it's such a horrible thing. But just imagine, you don't want extraneous magnetic field lines all over the place, right? I mean, you could be in the room with a compass needle and it'd point in some weird direction because somebody left this wire lying around. So one of the things you can do to clean up the world is you put this outer sheath on it, and one of the things it does is it literally encloses the magnetic field inside. And there's no magnetic field penetrating outside, even though you've got something that's carrying current. So it's a much cleaner system. What we'll find is that anytime you have a circuit with changing electric or magnetic fields, it really screws around with the current with the circuit. And so it's called induction. We'll be doing that soon as one of our topics. It's like the coolest thing in electromagnetism. But you'll find that this geometry allows you to not have that field bleeding out, messing with the rest of the world. Okay. That's a good place to start. Have a good week, Dan.